What are you guys selling?
You're drowning and I throw you a life jacket. Would you grab it? Yes. Good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns?
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know this.
That's it. I'm done.
Hello and welcome to Sacks and Jacks. I'm Tim Howell. You're Ricky on the board. S&P futures are actually down a little bit this morning. We were up a huge rally yesterday. We're down two. NASDAQ futures down 22. We had a big rally yesterday. A huge rally in gold, and that's down a little bit today too as well. It was up like $150 yesterday, which is kind of a lot for gold. Do we have Professor Carl?
Oh, you do.
Are you one of those guys that puts PhD after your name? You know.
Oh, good God. First off, I don't have one. Secondly, I wouldn't even if I did. I don't do the Joe Biden doctor.
Yeah, well.
Doctor. Because, by the way, just for all the listeners, if you actually call yourself doctor around me, given some of the stuff I've written on and some of the things that have been uncovered in the last, 5 years or so, probably ought to run. just saying.
Doctor is in medical doctor or is in PhD doctor?
Doctor is in any kind of doctor.
Yeah.
Medical, otherwise, yeah. I mean, yeah. But especially medical.
Well, my late lady doctor was COVID shots and was let me in on the idea that the state sent out a thing and anybody who went public with that was going to lose their license. So I don't know, she might be one you like.
Well, yeah, that's there's always this is always the excuse, right? Because I've heard the same thing, right? Because I know quite a few people. One of the things that I think is most interesting about this is that when it comes time for there to be accountability, if there ever does, in this area or with the shots or and it is not just limited there. Okay, I mean you probably heard the about the Senate hearing. It was about a week and a half ago now. Where they started talking about the childhood schedule and, because Kennedy has been making some noise, and of course he made a lot of noise before he was in charge of HHS, about this whole controversy over whether or not autism is linked to the childhood vaccines, right? I don't know if you recall, Chief, but during the early times of the crazy, the Henry Ford Health System in Southeast Michigan, which is a very well-respected medical group, they were the people that when my parents, being Southeast Michigan, largest group there, when my parents had issues, guess where they ended up, right? Duh.
Yeah. Well.
Well, but they found during the crazy, they found that basically they gave hydroxychloroquine to everybody that came into the ER with COVID. Right? Now, there was a lot of controversy over that because hydroxychloroquine has a known propensity to mess with the QT interval in your heart, which is a rather critical thing. Of course, if you're in the hospital, it's not very hard for them to monitor whether or not it's having an adverse effect, right, on your heart rhythm, because you're there. And so, they knew about this potential problem, but it's also been used off-label. It was originally an anti-malarial. It was used off-label for lupus. It's been used that way for a very long time, and a lot of people have had very good results by using it that way. So they did this, and they found a roughly 50% reduction in mortality. Literally handing it out like candy to everybody came in there, but with the monitoring to go with it, because if you had a pre-existing heart condition, it could be dangerous. And Fauci attacked them for doing this, they published the data. They put it out there in a formal publication. Said this is what we've done. These were the results. Here's the control group. Here's the sample. We did this with informed consent. Nobody knew what was going on and how to treat this thing originally. Of course, remember that in the first few months, nobody knew what the hell to do. And Fauci went after them with extreme vitriol. And their response was to issue a press release and said, "We're not going to talk about anything we're doing anymore. We're going to be doctors. Screw you. We're not getting involved in political aspects."
Well, yeah, the only issue with, well, there's two things. One, I'm right with you on this, but as you see, in this, we're supposed to be free in this country, right? And to a certain extent,
in theory,
and to a certain extent, the internet has become our, you can shoot stuff out there without using your own name and things like that, which I think is fairly damaging. But when you think about why people do it, I mean, we talked about when Bill Moriarty was on, hopefully he'll be on pretty soon. He was talking about when he was starting in the civil engineering business. He worked for, I believe, a place, Concert Townsend, here in Chicago, and they might have had 300 engineers, 250, something like that. I don't know. I'm not sure. When he comes back, I'll ask him. But because all those places are gone, and in a place is like 40,000 engineers now. They're worldwide, and if you're But this, what we're doing is we're having other people censure people instead of the government. In other words, if your company is getting a bag of cash from Trump, there's no way on earth that you could show up at a demonstration against him, even if it's just against the policy, which you're supposed to be able to do. So we're having people. So we're having these doctor groups now. Everybody's part of a group. Right. So we have the doctor group is censuring the doctors.
Right.
Which is not America to me, but
right. Well, and this is, this is part of the problem. But what I've pointed out repeatedly, and in this context, during the Senate hearing, what got introduced into the congressional record. So now you can read it, because this was a study that the Henry Ford medical system and the physicians who ran it were prevented from publishing. Okay, now this was done. This study was done quite some time ago. It was like 2011 was when it was originally done. So this has been known now for 15 years. They found a control group among their patients, which is really hard to do, of children who had no shots. All right. Now, of course, the only place you're likely to find that in America is like among the Amish, right?
Yeah.
All right. But they actually found it, and a large enough intervention group, kids who had taken the shots, so they found enough people to actually have a statistically valid sample, which is really tough to do on the control side when it comes to this sort of thing, which is one of the problems that has always been there. Is that you say, well, my kid got this shot and then this happened, but where's the control so that you can make the association, even though that's all it is when you're talking about retrospective analysis, it's association, but you have to have a control, otherwise you'd know nothing.
Well, the only problem with that one is, now, my friend, once in a while I get to sneak one by you. It's very rare.
Let me finish up,
and then I'm going to sneak one by you here.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so this study ends up into the congressional record, and they found that they did not find an autism link, which is very interesting. What they did find, however, is a hazard ratio of 2.5 to 50, so 1.5 times more likely for a child who had taken these shots to have a serious and debilitating chronic condition, so things like asthma, autoimmune disorders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it was an astoundingly high ratio. All right, the hazard ratio was not 105 or something, 5% of greater risk. It was 250. All right, so. And the lead physician who ran this, he testified that essentially he was told that if they tried to publish this, if he did it independently, it was rejected at the various journals, and if he attempted to publish it independently, he'd have his ticket punched, and he'd never work in field again.
Well, I mean, even me just being an observer. You gotta observe if you're going to be on Snacks and Jacks. I mean, an observer. Me being an observer is when every you know, I'm a pretty big guy, too big, but I've always had issues with medication. And people look at me and they say, you can take this, it's no problem. The doctor, it is a problem, you know, type of thing.
Yeah.
Some people have no problems with stuff, and, you know, I always have. I mean, for whatever reason.
Well, everybody's different. Yeah.
And so one day, vaccines, I think, in general, I think most of them are safe. I would never, just for my own stuff, I would never take three of them on the same day. Yet they give them to these kids. I would never even think of that. And I'll tell you, talk about a weird story. I don't know what the hell my mother did. I don't know, she did something, and she ended up in the emergency room. I don't know if she cut her hand or she did enough. It was nothing serious. And they gave her the, when was the last time you had a tetanus shot? Which, of course, was God knows when. Nobody goes. You're supposed to get every 10 years. Of course, nobody does.
Right.
So they give her this tetanus shot. They still happen to be showing up for breakfast. They go, man, what happened to your head? It's like huge. She goes, yeah, I know. I got a problem. I'm going to follow my doctor. But they didn't tell her. It was tetanus, diphtheria, and whooping cough.
It was DTAP.
Yeah, and she goes, yeah. When I was a kid and they gave me the whooping cough thing, I had a problem. If they would have told me that, I would have said, get out of here. And yet they didn't even tell her. I mean, what's the point? I mean, I haven't had a puppy in a long time, but I know way back in the day, you used to have to go 4 weeks in a row for puppy shots.
Right.
They didn't put them all in one shot.
They probably do now, which is even more bizarre.
But
they don't put them all in one shot, but what they do is give them to the puppy for, you know, bang, 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 right? They stab them four times.
Well, they used to have to bring them every week.
Yeah, well, I know. I grew up with animals in the house. The only thing I have an indoor cat, okay, but the only thing he gets is the rabies shot, and I do the, and by the way, the 3-year and the 1-year is exactly the same thing. They just charge you three times as much money. And one of the reasons I give him the 3-year is because that way you only get stabbed every 3 years.
Audrey's little one, she's 19, she can't have the rabies shots anymore, so she can't go in the dog park.
Yeah, well, you know, the
of course, how's she going to get rabies, for God's sake, living in a house at 19, but maybe.
The whole reason I give, the cat never leaves the house, okay, because he's an indoor cat. So obviously he can't get it either. But, you know, besides the fact that, you know, that the state has a hissy fit if you have a domestic animal without it.
Yeah.
The other issue is that if he gets out and gets into a fight with an outdoor animal who happens to be rabid, he'll be destroyed.
Yeah.
Okay, and I like him. So, I mean...
You put a little leash on him and bring him out on the porch with you, or is he strictly indoors?
Oh, no, I do. Well, cats tend not to like that very much unless you start doing it when they're tiny little kittens.
Cats are odd creatures, but...
Cats are very odd creatures. But, do I try to get him to put up with it? Yeah, and I wish he would, but he really doesn't like it. So, it is what it is. You know, one of the things that I think is fascinating, since we like to talk about markets here, or at least we should,
yes,
right, 'cause it's called stocks and jocks.
Yes.
So, you know, this thing that you noted about the VIX going crazy, of course, you know, now this morning is, 18.5?
Yeah, it settled way back then, but still, that's a high settle 18, number.
Well, 18.5 is still, you know, that's an 18% move, you know, supposedly over 12 months, right? I mean, that's what supposedly predicts. One of the things that I think is so interesting about this is that just like in 2007, what supposedly set this off, and this has been one of my themes forever, is that these different banking institutions have had pledged to various industry groups, have had assets pledged that were supposedly first lines that were not. Okay, that was what happened with First Brands. Is that they were essentially, First Brands essentially was a factoring shop, okay? I mean, that's what they were doing. And they were pledging invoices more than once. Okay, well...
These tricks are not new. It's like fetishes.
This is like the oldest crap ever, right? Yeah. And then this other one that hit Zions Bank and some of these other regionals is apparently centered in commercial real estate, where loans were packaged up and marketed, you know, put into syndication that were supposedly first lines, and again, they were not. Okay, so I mean, now if if you happen to have, if you bought that garbage and it defaults, you're going to get zero, because the actual first line people are the ones that have recourse. You've only got recourse if there's something left, and there probably won't be, right? So at that point, those are zeros, and that came out. Now, here's the basic problem.
Oh, okay, back up just to hear. What Carl's talking about is a few of the, we could, you know, a few of the Stocks and Jacks listeners, we could it's probably up some, Carl, but with $2 million, we could open a bank.
Right.
And we could put it, like they did in the South Side, right next to a train station. And if you get a couple of nice tellers that everybody likes or can speak languages, like the place I go at the Lakeside, they're in the Chinese community, they're every place. Their tellers can speak 27 different languages. The Polish community, they're everywhere. The Ukrainian community. And anyway, so if we did that, we start to get all these deposits, which we probably would. Now, the question is, what are we going to do with them? Now, if you're paying somebody, for instance, at the credit union, my dad worked, my stepfather, they paid 3%. And they had to get enough loans, like at 6%, because that's what they charge, they'd have to pay you to 3%. I mean, this is a business, duh. So you open up this bank, and all of a sudden, everybody starts trapping you all this money. So now you got $10 million worth of scratch, and you're paying, let's say, 2% on it. Well, how do you pay it? Well, you got to get some loans. That's what banks do. So, but a small bank like that probably is not going to finance some huge, well, not even a huge, but a big commercial building next door. They probably aren't going to have a car loan department. They probably aren't even going to have a credit card. So what they're going to do is either invest it in treasuries, or they're going to, or somebody's going to come by, like Carl, and say, hey, for guys just like you, we've put together a basket of commercial loans. We've rated them, you know, double A or something, and they're going to return 5%, and we're going to take $1 million of the dollars, and we're going to put it in there, thinking it's safe, right?
Right, right.
And it ought to be. But, you know,
if everything is on the up and up,
right,
then it's fine. Yeah. The problem is, of course, it's not.
Right. Well, then you got a problem, because now your bank is like, you took these people's dough and you put it somewhere you thought was safe. Although I don't know if I'd trust those guys as much. I'd probably have as much in treasury as I could. But still, I mean, you're not going to make a lot of money there. But, you know, go ahead. You're right. You're spot on. Yeah. I don't know. What if those things fold? And then a bunch of banks that thought they were doing the safe thing now are screwed.
Well, yeah, because, you know, if you have a home equity line on top of your mortgage and you don't pay, you can't, right? You lose your job. You can't pay. The primary mortgage holder gets made whole first.
Yep.
When they foreclose and sell your house, and the home equity guy gets zero unless the sale price is greater than, you know, the primary mortgage. Now, if it is, then, you know, then they get their recovery. They get some recovery back. But there's a very real possibility, if you're not in first position on any kind of mortgage or any kind of secured credit, that you're going to end up with nothing. And it, you know, I mean, it's one thing to lose, you know, 20% or 30% of your money. It's quite another to lose 100.
Well, and, you know, the thing of it is, okay, a lot of it is legit. When we get back to the market here in a second.
Well, I'll tell you what my...
But you know who was the most... the initial guy like this was... God, what the hell's the guy's name? The guy with the toupee that went to jail? What the hell's his name? Milken. Milken, right?
Oh, yeah, Milken, yeah.
Well, what Milken did was... And he's one of these guys that was really a kind of an inventive genius in the industry, and then, you know, got caught up in his own error or something. But in those days, if you want to get financing, you could do two things: you go to a bank where they'd absolutely rip you off, or you go to Salomon and Goldman, and they'd rip you off even worse, because that was your that was your two, you know. But what he did is he said, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to have this junk bonds are really not investment grade. But he said, we're going to put these packages together and say, all right, we're going to go out and get 10 guys like Carl that have a small computer firm, 10 guys at Chief. Well, you can't loan them to a brokerage firm, but if you could, you loan to a brokerage firm, and we're going to put these together, but we're going to make sure that your package is 20 of them, and we're going to return 10%, or even if a few of the people go out, you're still going to get 9.
Right.
Which is better than the 7 you're going to get somewhere else.
Which, by the way, is a perfectly legitimate structure if it's honest.
But the thing of it is, they actually whatever they expected their non-performing to be, right, came in like about half or even less than that. So they actually returned way better than people. This is when they first did it. It's the people doing it. It's not the structure, right? It's the honesty and the people that are doing it.
Right. But, right. Well, and that's. But see, here's the thing. You know, all of this comes down.
Then he went to jail.
Anyway, this. Yeah. Well, he did. Nobody does nowadays.
Well, yeah. He got involved with some guys that, of course, everybody in the industry hated him because he gave people.
Well, I understand that, but all of this, when you get down to it, whether it's the medical stuff, whether it's, you know, anywhere else in business and whatever, and what's going on now, and Chief, you as well as everybody else, you've been around this business long enough. You know, there's never only one cockroach.
No.
Okay. And you know, if you see one scurrying on the floor, there's 1,000 of them in your wall. All right. You may not see them, but they're there. And if you start pulling walls apart, you're going to find them. And the thing is that this is the same kind of pattern that we saw in 2006 and 2007, and we know what happened, you know, after that. So it's also the same pattern we saw in 1999, and we know what happened there too. And the thing that that really, really gets under my skin is not that there are people that are dishonest. It's that we have, across the economy, across the markets, across all different areas, it's that no one goes to jail. You have, you know, we have this crazy person who stabbed the Ukrainian immigrant on the train, okay, who's dead, been arrested, he'd done 5 years. They let him out, and then he had committed another offense, and they didn't jail him. You have this other kid he's like 15, he's been arrested like 120 times or something like this.
That's got to be a record.
In the same city. Okay, where she got stabbed. All right. You have these people that come into these stores and do these huge snatch and grab and run kind of things, right? In general, these are criminal acts, right? The whole reason these kinds of things go on is they don't fear going to jail. They just don't. And they have very good reason to not fear going to jail, because they don't go to jail. Okay, when they get caught, they get a slap on the wrist and they're let out. What's this whole Epstein thing with, you know, now Guifre's memoir has been published with some extraordinarily violent claims regarding, you know, princes and, oh, by the way, Ehud Barak apparently is referenced in there.
Jim, boy, I'm shocked.
Gee, so am I, that grandstanding politicians are, in many cases, rather creepy, right? I mean, this is a surprise. That's not to say they all are, but the basic problem is that there is some percentage of people, and there always have been, that are neither moral or ethical. They don't give a crap about anything except themselves.
They're not immoral, they're amoral.
Which is way worse. They just don't care. And the only thing that deters them, the only thing, is that if the law says you do this, you go to jail, you have to go to jail. Now, we have 15 U.S.C. Chapter 1, which says if you do any one of a whole bunch of things, you go to jail. It doesn't say you get fined. It says you go to jail. The entire medical system is riven through with violations.
You're asking the people that have become the criminals to put themselves in jail.
Well, what I'm saying is that if, you know, same thing with 8 U.S.C. 1324 when it comes to illegal immigrants, but these things, if we are going to actually solve any of these problems, if we're going to actually ever stop this kind of thing on a forward basis, people who do these sorts of things have to go to jail. Not get fined,
but some of the stuff, I'm surprised even on the jail part though. And, you know, it's not just Trump. It's people who, however you were brought up. I mean, you know, and I admit, essentially being brought up in an Irish Catholic ghetto where everybody went to church, and I was doing I was working for Allied Vanlines of all places. I was helping out this guy in Ohio at a moving and storage place.
Right.
So I'm staying in this motel. It was a hotel. It had hallways. They didn't open up their parking lot.
Right.
And I go down to breakfast, and I see all these young girls that may be 15 walking along in these little, they're not bathing suits, what do they call them, leotard? I have no idea. Anyway, they don't cover that much, even though they're one piece, right?
Right.
And they're all walking by, and I felt creeped out by the whole thing. And the guy comes by, and I go, what is this? And the guy goes, oh, this is a beauty contest. And I go, you gotta be bleeping.
Yeah.
You know, and yet some people, and yet there's a tape, and I'm not saying this is a law or anything like that. There's this big hotel in New York, and there's this beauty pageant, and evidently Trump's running the beauty pageant.
Right.
And there's all these old white guys and a few women, which is even more bizarre, sitting at this big long table in tuxedos and formal gowns.
Oh, yeah.
And these young girls are walking in, and they're like 14 or 15 or 16 or whatever the hell they were, parading in front of all these guys and ladies sitting there drinking and eating shrimp. And I'm going, I felt unwashed watching it. I mean,
well, yeah, you're like,
but yet some people think that that's all okay. I'm not saying we should go to jail, but there's a creep measure here too, in addition to a law measure.
Oh, there is, but you know, but the thing is that the reality of it is. Beyond the fact, you know, I mean, I was raised a little bit differently than some of these people, right? Because, you know, my basic approach has always been, well, you know, first off, that's wrong, right? All right, you know, ripping people off is wrong, all right? But beyond that, my expectation is that if I did it anyway, I was going to go to jail.
Yeah.
All right? And so, you know, that, and even if you're in extremis, you know, okay, I'm out of work. I'm running out of money. You know, the options are go bust your butt or be rather hungry, you know, live in your car, whatever, or, you know, or steal something, right? My expectation is if I do the steal something, I'm going to go to jail.
Okay? Well,
but that's my expectation. Now, if you take people and you make the expectation you won't go to jail.
No, you won't.
You're going to get an awful lot of the stealing.
Well, you also have the, I mean, everybody, when Joel comes on, let me know, please, and you talk about the people who smash and grab and stuff, and nobody wants that to happen. Plus, it happens right in front of you. You feel you could get, like, hurt in it. But if you were to say, boy, you know, I kind of sense this announcement from somewhere, the Fed, the president, it could be anybody, right? This announcement looks to me like people had the information before it was public. And, yeah. Oh, by the way, it looks like a lot of trading took place. Now, I can't prove it, but I'm at this a long time. You know, I can sort of tell when they all hit together and kind of when they don't, right? And, you know, there are systems that can kind of track it. I'm going to say that if a couple people did that and a couple of these things lately, they made more money than all the smash and grabbers in this country in the last 6 months. Not even close. So, I mean, there's a question of degree on this, too. I mean, there is,
but, Chief, if you want to, the thing is this, the losses that happen, you know, if I make a foolish investment decision and I buy I buy stock in a company that blows up, then I lose my money, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's...
Worry about stock in a company that's way too overvalued. It doesn't even have to blow up.
But I'm saying people make mistakes, right?
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, because we're human. We all, to err is human, right? That's the way it is. The problem with all of this is that if you look at the kinds of circular financing that are going on right now and the things that are in the space today, especially when it comes to technology, I mean, the latest little bit of BS that goes on in this AI business is that, and this just came out fairly recently, that these companies are booking their depreciation schedules on this equipment on 10-year depreciation schedules. Okay, now I can tell you, having been in this, I mean, this is how I made all my money since I was like 13, is programming computers, all right? So, I mean, I know a little bit about this stuff. This is my wheelhouse. I have never, in 40 years of being in this field, seen a single piece of emerging or advancing technology that has a service life of more than 2 to 3 years. Ever.
Well, it's like depreciating. It's like depreciating a truck over 30 years instead of 10.
I'm just saying, Chief. It's not that it won't work for 20 years or 10 years, because it will. That's not the problem. The problem is the newer generation will be faster, cheaper, and use less power, and also produce less heat, which means it uses less power twice, because you have to pay for the air conditioning and get the heat out of the room or it melts. So if you have it on your books and you have not made enough money in revenue and profit to pay for it in 2 years at an outside edge for compute resources or store and storage, by the way, for that aspect too. If you haven't paid for it in 2 years, you're screwed, because the guy down the street is going to buy the new stuff and he's going to destroy you, simply because his operating costs are half yours.
Okay? Well, yeah, because you're talking about the intersection here. We should tee this one up on Friday, because
this is pure fraud, though, Chief. Well, and the thing is that they're stating this stuff in securities filings, and nobody goes to jail for this stuff, and it is a well-known fact.
Well, Carol is saying is that the legal depreciation, first of all, if you buy something, you would rather depreciate it faster because it comes off your taxes faster. Right? On your tax books, you're going to do it faster. Correct?
Well, it...
I mean, if you go out and buy a truck that's going to last you 10 years and you paid $100,000 for it, you'd like to be able to deduct $50,000 a piece for the first 2 years, assuming you've made the $50,000
in cash. And by the way, accelerated depreciation is, has been an on and off thing, and it's on now. But what I'm talking about...
Yeah, you're talking about something different. I'm going to tell people that this truck is going to be every bit as good for the next 10 years as it was the first 2 years. That ain't happening.
Well, it's the capitalization ratios that people are putting into their models to value these firms. And it's coming off the premise that these things are going to be revenue generators for 10 years. No, they're not.
That's what I'm trying to explain here, is it's two separate subjects.
Right. One is taxes. The other is actual what your CapEx models.
Because the people listening to you are probably saying, what's the problem? You want to depreciate this as fast. That's not what you're talking about. You're talking about, you're saying it's going to be a useful life is 10 years, and it's not.
That's correct.
Yes.
Its useful life is 2 years.
Right. Big difference.
And on switching, it's maybe 3. So your routers and switches and stuff like that is maybe 3.
So, when you go in the era when I worked at Pullman, if you went and bought a big punch press, it actually probably had a useful life of 40 years.
Where
40 years from now, it's every bit as good as the day you bought it.
It's still punch presses. Yeah. Right.
But that's not happening in what you're talking about. Even though
has never happened. Never.
Still no Joel, eh?
He's up.
He's up?
I just saw him pop up.
All right, buddy. I think Kenny's coming on. If not, we'll hear from you in a bit. Joel, you want to just pop right in, buddy?
Yeah, good morning, Chief.
How are you?
Good morning. What complicated stuff you guys talking about?
Carl is concerned that a lot of these business models that some of these AI people are putting together, they're investments in some of the stuff they're talking about. They're talking about it like a 10-year life on it. And he's saying that that nowhere in the computer business, as long as he's been here, has anything in that area had a really serious useful life of 10 years. It's more like 2 or 3 when somebody gets something better. So you have to be careful when people value their companies based on 10 years or more, when it really is not really all that true. Which...
Well, is he talking about 10 years to create it?
No, he's talking about if you go out and buy like an NVIDIA chip, and you think that the life of this chip being the best and brightest is going to be 10 years. He says that's always in that business, nothing's good for 10 years. Somebody's got one faster, cheaper, or less energy somewhere along the line.
I'm not going to disagree with them. I would say market don't care.
No.
Market don't care.
What I want to ask you is, we had the VIX shoot up real quick to 25, and now it's back down to 18.5 after a couple up days. Actually, it's up a little this morning. Being somebody who stood in the OEX pit for 20 years, including 87, you have to be. Everybody treats this VIX like it's a stock. It's not. I mean, obviously Russell wrote a book on the VIX, but this is the price of. Essentially, it's the price of insurance. It's the second derivative of the curve, not the first. So you have to, I know everyone knows what that means, but chill for a second while I explain it. When people go to, if the market has a certain amount of danger to it, like always, risk factor, you may go and you might say, I don't need any insurance. I don't need to buy put protection, which essentially is insurance on your stock. I don't need to buy it. And all of a sudden, market looks a little weird. We got these up down days and crazy stuff around the world. I won't say Washington, but around the world, there is risk in the air, for lack of a better term. So you start buying more protection, and a little more and a little more. Well, the people selling it to you, there's groups that sell puts. There's people that sell puts so they can get long stock lower. There's people who sell cash secured puts. We do some of that, cash secured, not naked. There's people who do that stuff. But then all of a sudden, if everybody smells a rat and starts buying more and more and more, there's only a finite amount that the people who, the market makers, the people who trade floor and make markets and put, they're not in business to insure the world. They're in business to make a market. So when you, there's a lot of natural call sellers. Anybody who owns a share of stock can sell a covered right. Those are natural call sellers. There's not a lot of natural put sellers. And I know this because I was in the OEX 1987 in a crash. All of a sudden, everybody has a limit. Even these big firms, they might say, I'll go short, net 4,000 SPY puts. And the guy wants to buy the 4 to 5, the answer is no. Or the price is really, really high. The fact that the other day, the last Friday or Thursday, the VIX went from 18 to like, or 19 to 25 in one afternoon, that is a very telltale thing to me, Joel, because that means, and I actually have cocktails once in a while, guys are in that business, they're getting pretty full up. They're very concerned about their risk. They don't let those firms just go sell 20,000 one day because it looks like a good price. There are risk parameters on all these places. And when more and more people start wanting to buy insurance, the answer is going to be no someday, maybe, because I've seen it happen. And so no other thing you trade has that type of a background to it. So be careful with this VIX. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Very good explanation there, Chief. I kind of use the... I follow the VIX. Obviously, you need to. What I found is more important for me is, finding the expansion. It's the same thing in the average daily ranges, right? And what you want is, smaller ranges and slow and steady climbs. That this market's been anything but that. It's been big moves, and so far. The big drops, which are instigated by you know who and you know when,
yep,
are immediately bought up, immediately, right, when a contra truth comes out. And then you get the corresponding rise. To me, my old-fashioned way of looking at things, I don't like that kind of market. I like a market that's more slow and steady. Trading, well, fundamentals, we can throw them out the door.
Oh, yeah, we don't care about those anymore.
Yeah, those are irrelevant. But what I think, the other thing, just, you can't fight the market. You can't fight what's currently going on in the market. And I'm not one for conspiracy theories or this, that, and the other thing. But there's a hell of a lot of money being made and lost on these random fluctuations. And I think the onus is on us, is as investors, is to try and, take advantage of it, right? And it's getting hard. And the computers are fast, the computers are smart. I think people just have to look at where they're at. And I know you do this with your clients and stuff, and try and focus, whatever. The VIX, we all know buying puts, timing for long-term protection can be difficult.
Well, plus they're extremely expensive, amazingly expensive right now. Yeah.
But you have to be, at your comfort level. Selling calls, you are giving up a big move in your stock, right?
If
that happens. Selling calls, it doesn't protect you below the downside of your, you know, of what you sold the call for. And if you're selling the call, if you're putting collars on, then you know you really need a big move. So I think it's just comfort level with cash, taking targets, being comfortable with your overall portfolio, doing a little, you know, asset relocation where it's needed, not getting too concentrated in a couple stocks, and just riding this out. I mean, right now, you know, you have the administration behind the market, you have Fed lowering interest rates, looks like you have a decent earnings season. Hard to be bearish, Chief. It's just hard to be bearish, and it's hard to take the VIX, you know, at full value there when, you know, when you see when these declines. And for me with the VIX, you just got to be cat quick. I mean, if you have these on and there's a move, you gotta be there to take advantage of it because it seems to come right back in.
Well, you have, I mean, I don't know, I sense, my sense is I'm sensing the worst in terms of the people running the place. Because I think they're smart enough to cash in on this. But the thing the other week, was a week before last, where the 100% tariff on China, what the hell was that all about? And then we went down, what, almost 4% in the one day?
Mm-hmm.
And then over the weekend, Trump says, well, this whole thing with China is all going to blow over, or something along those lines. We came back almost the exact same amount on Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I guess it could be just the musings of a madman. But those people know that those are trading type of things, and what you end up with the investors, and we have a lot of them here to trade through our IB platform. All people are worried about is we're down. Who's ever in charge doesn't like it when the market's down. You got to buy the dip, and they do. And every time somebody does that, for the last however many years, not just with Trump, with other people, it's been, I'm going to say, probably the most successful non-strategy that became a strategy in my lifetime, to buy the dip. I can't even imagine that being a strategy, and yet if I'd have done it for the last 15 years, I'd be more money than Avarice, right? I mean, And yet, I still can't do it for myself or my people, because that's no strategy. Good Lord. But it is.
Now, just don't sell the dip.
Yeah. You can't sell the dip.
All right. I got a hot, right, Chief. We did talk about sports. We'll do that next week. Go Blue, and my Lions are looking okay.
Yeah,
and the Red Wings are off to a good start. We'll see what happens with the
Pistons.
Well,
the Bulls, I think, open with the Pistons tonight, don't they? Or tomorrow?
I don't know. I'll have to check that out. But everybody, be safe out there. Treat each other with respect. Go Blue.
All right. Do we have Kenny?
We do.
Hey, what's up, bud? How are you? You sound great.
I'm good. How are you? I owe you an apology because I was so sick last week. I slept right through our appointment, and I feel horrible about that.
Well, you know, a little snooze is not so bad. At your age, you know, you need a nap every now and then.
I know, but I woke up at 8:20 and went, oh, shit.
Okay. Well, you missed, people were probably trading, you know, so what's going on here? What do you like? It's kind of the
mix. Well, listen, I will say, it's an old story now, right? I mean, it's getting old, this whole tech story, but every day it gets a little bit better. I mean, yesterday, Trump signs an $8.5 billion rare earth deal with Australia, kind of taking China out of that control position. Remember last week, China threatened to, you know, threaten the world, not even the U.S. I mean, really countries around the world with, you know, new export controls on rare earth minerals. And, you know, they were really at the nexus of the supply chain. And now yesterday, Trump, you know, makes this deal with Australia that apparently they've been working on for 4 or 5 months, and it came to fruition yesterday, which is bullish because now, you know, they've diversified the supply chain away from China. And so tech, once again, the rare earth minerals took off yesterday. And then tech, once again, that depends on all the rare earths, had another great day. So it's hard to argue against it. And I'm really not arguing against this fourth industrial revolution that we're in with technology. I think it's very much in its infancy. I don't think you can compare it at all to the dot-com bubble at all. I think it's two very different things. But, you know, in that sense, we continue to get kind of bullish news. And yes, to your comment that you just made about, you know, Trump said the other day, last week, about the 100% tariffs and the market sold off. And then over the weekend, he goes, oh, it's all going to be good. And the market rallied back. I agree with you. I'm completely as frustrated with that tone, with that language, with the way it's done and who knew about it and who took advantage of the move and all that stuff. And I think everybody should be investigated. I do. I think they should all be investigated because I do think it's bullshit. But Those are the tensions we're under right now, and everybody playing in the market understands that. They understand that the headlines can come like that, whether or not you agree with them, and you and I are on the same side on that. It is what it is, but I think overall the market is in a good place, right? While I think it might be stretched a little bit, I don't think it's going to be, I don't think we're in for any huge correction. I'd love to see a 5 or 8% pullback. I would love to see that, but I don't think we're going to get it. I just don't think we're going to get
Kenny,
it.
What, every time, when, it's you're our man at the top of the chain here when it comes to what's going on in New York, what's going on in Washington in terms of the market. When you see, you know, people sit there and sign this deal with Australia.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's good deal, bad deal, whatever. It makes sense to, you know, people need this stuff, and oh, by the way, it makes sense to cooperate. On the other hand, and does the normal person who knows more about trading maybe than me, and a New York Stock Exchange like you have been, does anybody there have any idea essentially what is going on in the rare earth world and what was just signed? Because, I mean, we've talked about that with guests and with Carl a lot in the show. The reason why China is in charge of the rare earth world is not because they have more rare earth metals. Nobody else wants to process them because it's dirty as hell. So the idea, what do you think, if you could put it in your backyard, what do you think the time frame is here for a rare earth processing facility? I'm going to say 2 decades.
Yeah, in the United States, sure, because we don't do it. But Australia is already doing it, right? And so I agree with you. Is it dirty? Yes, it's dirty. I agree it's dirty. But the fact is, the world needs it. We need it for all the stuff we do. And why, once again, here's where I get crazy. Why, once again, is the world or the U.S., you know, setting ourselves up to be so dependent on China, right? Whether it's technology, whether it's pharmaceuticals, whether it's whatever else. I said, we put ourselves in that position, so shame on us. Well, now that, you know, we're in this position in terms of trade.
Hey, did they used to say on the New York floor when you said we, hey, do you got a mouse in your pocket? That's what we used to say here. Kenny, it's I'm not disagreeing with you at all, but it's somewhat obvious. When you look at the people here and what they're making versus companies, what they're making, we have essentially offshored pollution and child labor.
Well, we've offshored pollution, right. Child labor, you know, I wish we weren't offshoring child labor.
But we are.
We've
done that. And it was amazingly obvious that that's kind of what was happening. You know, I don't know if I tell you this. Can I tell you a really quick story? There was a time before Jim Tyree died where I was in the Economic Club of Chicago. Talk about the hoi polloi group, right? You go in tuxedos, you listen to somebody talk, and you have dinner, and they always made sure you got out of there at the exact right time. The guy who was giving a talk had to shut up because they already had to make their train, right? But it was a big shindig, and all of a sudden one night, you know, I get there early, and there's a little cocktail party, and these little tiny tables. So I'm sitting there, and I talk to this lady who happens to be in the Chinese embassy, and she's telling me, I said, okay, what if somebody wanted to, because we just said somebody on the show, I think, that was had to move his don't call him Teflon, whatever coatings are on pots and pans, he had to move to China because that was the people who made the pots were now in China, so he couldn't make the coatings here when the pots are in China, right? He didn't want to go there, but he did.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, you know, I talk to this lady, and she wanders off, or I wanders off, and I'm talking to another lady, and she says, well, you know, my company wants a Chinese, you know, we need to go over to China and start some stuff up because it's cheaper and blah, blah, blah. Well, what the lady just told me is that if you want to do that, you go to the embassy or someplace like that, somebody connected, and they connect you to a guy who I'm sure is the son of one of the people in the party, right? And they'll help you find a spot over there, and they become your consultant, insultant, whatever you want to do. He or she is your person that helps you find the place, making sure it's near where your supply stuff is and everything, and they help you get the place. They're in charge of keeping labor under their thumb so you don't have a strike or anything like that. It's all amazingly, and I'm sure our guys love that. Wait a minute, let me get this straight. Somebody's going to help me go over there. I'm sure you had to pay that person a boatload probably. So you're going to give me essentially a consultant to help me put this thing all together. And at the end of the day, I'm paying $2 an hour instead of 12. And oh, by the way, I don't really care if they're women or kids or whatever they are. And I'm never going to have a strike. I don't have to worry about health insurance. I mean, it wasn't the you and me we that did this, Kenny. Other people did. And we allowed it. And somehow we allowed it collectively. I don't know how we did or how we could have stopped it or whatever. But, and by the way, it's still happening. So it's not like it's new.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I understand that. And so, you know, your question is, does anyone realize what was signed? I you know, whether they know the particulars or not, what they do know is that this is a benefit, right? It's a benefit to the country. It's really a benefit to the world that, you know, you kind of diversify away from China. So it's positive. And you saw that reaction yesterday in, you know, certainly the rare earth stocks, Albemarle, ALB and MP for sure, as well as the REMX, which is the kind of the rare earths ETF. It's a way for people to play it. If they don't want to pick a single name, they can pick kind of the group. You know, that was up, I think, 1.8% yesterday on top of what it's already up year to date. On the one hand, I think it's exciting. But on the other hand, yeah, do they know exactly what was signed? No, all they know is that this rare earth mineral deal was signed. It's going to be a benefit to Australia, a benefit to the United States, and really a benefit to the globe as it kind of takes, you know, as it kind of takes that dependence on China, it removes a little bit of it.
I'm trying to find the line here between, by the way, do I think it's probably a good deal than not having it? I'm going to say yes, but I also know I didn't read it. You know, so I'm trying to find the line of whether it's really people knowing that in 5 years we're not going to be as near dependent on China, or 4 years or six, when to do it all ourselves would have been 10. Is that a positive thing? Absolutely. But are the people that piled in yesterday piling in just because the momentum trade is now up and it's running up, or do they all read it? I don't think anybody read it.
No, well, it's interesting, right? I certainly think there are people that have been in it and took more advantage, but I do think then there are new people that go, you know, oh my God, look at this, what a great deal, and they jump in because, once again, it's you know, more good news on technology. So I think it kind of feeds on itself. But look, I, for one, you know, I did not jump in on the rare earth trade yesterday, partly because it's up, you know, fairly substantially year to date, and so I want to kind of wait and see how this plays out. But I have exposure to it because I have other technology, right? So I own, I've got fairly large positions in other parts of the technology space. So, you know, in a roundabout way, I'm still participating, right?
Yep. Well, what is your nervousness? I even, well, caught a bit of Kramer last night because he stopped at the ATM, and they have a big thing, and he was on when I'm waiting in line at the ATM. So he was talking about how he was concerned, and this is, you know, I don't really listen to Kramer all that much, but he was concerned that the AI piece of these indexes is reaching a really high point. It's not even the companies anymore. It's the product. It's almost like, you know, 2000, where it was the dot bomb thing. You know, he says, you know, if you think AI is played itself out to the upside, you almost can't invest in the Qs. Or in the, even also, even the spiders, maybe. Spiders, maybe right. Not as much. He's got a point there. You know, these indexes can get to the point where they're not even really, you know, a new client, Kenny, and thankfully for him, he's mostly in Apple and in Microsoft and something he wants to diversify. I said, well, you can't diversify into the Qs. You're buying the same thing.
Right, you're buying the same thing.
The spider. You know, I don't know.
Listen. A lot of those. If you try to diversify into the, you know, to the growth ETF, the SPYG, you're buying the same thing. Or the Dan Ives, you know, AI ETF, the IVES, which is that new Dan Ives AI/tech growth ETF, you're buying the same thing. And so it's tough to diversify away from it unless you diversify completely into other sectors, which is kind of the conversation I had yesterday on Fox Business. I was on with Liz Claman. And so we were talking about, you know, all the excitement around tech. I go, listen, you have to start talking about other sectors. It's great to have tech, and people have tech, and I have tech, and it's great. But you got to start to diversify away. You can't be 60 years old and be all tech. You just can't. And so you got to start talking about, you know, healthcare and other places in the system where you're going to be able to find some diversity. Listen, Accenture was one of the names I said you should buy yesterday. Well, guess what? Accenture is a consulting firm in the tech space.
Yeah.
So you can't even get away from it, but it's on sale.
Why did you... the stack was... We have a lot of Accenture here.
Right.
That people have... that concentration issues that I manage. And when we got the stack, it was 340 to 380 from the various people we have it. Now it's 240.
Right.
I'm going to say we made, between selling calls and having put protection, out of the $100, we probably made 70 back. Not 100.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to do the 100.
No, but it's actually, if you look at it, it traded down there, but now it is trading back up. It's building that base, and it has started to move off that low of 240. I think it's trading 255 now, isn't it?
No, it's 242, down again yesterday.
Wait, let me see. Is it two?
I'm staring right at it.
Oh, 242. Yeah. Okay, 242.
This thing looks like
a
dead dog.
The trend line is what, a 244?
It looks like
a... short 246. The short-term trend line is 246. But it seems to be, bouncing around right down here, and it feels to me like it wants to push up and through. But again, even though I'm trying to diversify away, that is still technology, right? Because
yeah.
They're a consulting firm in the tech space. So it's interesting. You try to diversify away, and you find yourself continuing to be in the tech space. But that's going to be true anywhere because everyone's using tech, whether it's agentic AI, whatever it is, whether it's banks, whether it's industrial, healthcare, they're all in it somehow. So you're getting exposure everywhere you go to some part of the technology space.
My whole fear in this whole thing, Kenny, is, and it goes from company to company to the point where I don't even want to say it on the air because it almost feels like I'm giving investment advice, which I'm not. You look at any of these things, and I'm not going to give the numbers out. Look at Snow, look at Palantir, look at even Microsoft, as big as it is. Look at NVIDIA, look at any of these things, and look at... Scrub the P.E. ratio out of your head for a second. Just look at revenue per share.
Yeah.
You Oracle, you'll be horrified. And not to the extent that any one of these companies can't continue to go up. They all can. But if you take the top 15 of them, or 10 or 12 or something,
yeah,
and you pencil it all out and you say, okay, here's a company that's trading 250. By the way, their revenue is like $10. it's like 30 times revenue. And you go, all right, well, if this company is going to quadruple their revenue, which they need to kind of grow into this price by any stretch of your and I's career, maybe go up five times, they might be able to do it. Because I don't, they could very well be the big winner. Now we got the next one. Now it's Kenny Pulcheri stack. Well, Kenny's the best. He might be able to do it. When I get to the 10th person, it's like I did this exact same calculation in 2000. I sit there and go, wait a minute, we better go colonize Mars, and there better be gold up there, because there's no the GDP's got to double or triple for these people to get anywhere in the close to these numbers. They all can. I mean, Microsoft, if they triple, which maybe they can by buying everybody else up, they all can't triple on revenue, because there's nobody's got enough money, can he?
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. So you gotta pick. You got to do your homework, and you got to be on top of it. And listen, when things get stretched, to your point, they're a little bit stretched, and I agree with you, this stretch. I think the trade is crowded. So I do think, and I'm very cautious, so while I own tech, I'm not chasing it up here. So if it backs off, I'm not going to get hurt because we own it lower, right? So if we have a pullback, it's okay. And that's why I'm looking for other places to put some money to work.
Last question, because Hal's probably listening, which I'll continue on with him. Some of this stuff, and I know when I go down this road, nobody knows the hell I'm talking about. Most of what I see in the market here is not stocks going up. It's not brilliant people buying stocks and having them go up. It's the fact that we're degrading what it's countered in, and that's dollars. Now, Trump has got this guy calling on the Fed. He's already calling for half a point. We've been pushing 5 to 6 to 7 money supply growth in an economy that's growing maybe 2, maybe. And now, if Trump has his way and his people, they're going to shove that to 7 or 8, which is egregious, in my opinion. And they may not stop there. Now, it's perfect if you own resorts and if you own ranches and things like that, because a couple of people in the administration supposedly are buying up all these soybean things in Minnesota where these guys are dying on. But anyway, I don't have proof of that, but I've heard it. if we start going with a money supply growth of 7, 8, 9, the market could continue to go up. But boy, yes, the health of the economy and society is going to take such a hit. I don't know. I don't want to be around that day when those two things collide. I mean, somehow or another, this is not right. We've been talking for how many years on the show that there's a fork in the road between the real economy and the market, and it seems like it's only getting wider, not narrower.
I agree with you. I think it does appear as if it's getting wider. I'm kind of hopeful that that the market, that the economy grows at such a pace that we're able to work it all in. Now maybe we're not. Maybe they're just growing the money supply too much and it's going to be impossible to do that. I hope not. But you're more in that space than I am. Money supply is not something that I consistently look at. You always do. But I'm hopeful that we get this economy to grow at a rate that's going to be able to absorb it.
Well, if we double the amount of money in the system and your stock doubles, don't think you're a genius.
Correct.
It's like having a stock split and think somebody gave you something for free.
You're right. Yeah, no, I hear you.
But nobody thinks that way. And why should you? You have a Fed that's never supposed to let that happen, so you should never have to think that way.
Well, okay, you should never have to think that way, but we could go all the way back. It started in my mind, when the great financial crisis happened and they cut rates to zero and then they held them there for 15 or 16 years, well beyond what they should have.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's part of the problem, right? So they screwed up at the Fed, in my opinion. They held them way too low for way too long. And so now it's going to be a matter of, it took us 15 years to do that. It's going to take us 15 years to kind of work out of it. It's not going to happen overnight for sure. And if it does, it's not going to be pretty.
It did once.
And methodical.
It did once, 1929.
Yeah, it did. Well, let's hope we don't go there
again. I surely don't. But I promise for sure. Last question: how does somebody, when you have a market that's up damn near 40% in a couple of years?
Yeah.
Why can somebody, and you don't do this, why does somebody get on TV and say, man, a 4% correction would be really healthy, and then you got to buy it? Where are they getting this memo from the big guy upstairs saying, when you get down 4 or 5, when you're up 40, that somehow that's the spot?
I don't know how they do that when they say that's the spot. I would like to see the market, we're up to, what are we up this year? We're up 15, 16% already on the S&P, I think. Right, but I'd love to see a 7 or 8% correction in the S&P this year, which still means we're still up 32 or 33% over the 2 years.
Yeah.
But there's got to be a significant enough pullback, and I think anywhere between 0 and 9.9% is well within the normal trading range. So I'm happy to take anything in that range and then use it as an opportunity. Because look, again, I'm not focused on tomorrow or next week. I'm really focused on the next year and the year after that and, 5 years out after that. So, like you, I've got a broader outlook. I'm not a day trader, so I'm not necessarily looking just for the short-term pullback and the rise again. I'm looking for an opportunity to and some key names. Yeah, because, when the market drops 5 or 8%, you get some names that are down 12 and 15%.
Yeah, oh, yeah, definitely. You throw the baby out with the bathwater.
So those are the names when the market's down 5%, you want to look for the names that are getting really beaten up, that are solid, good names, that have gotten beaten up just because people are nervous and need to raise cash, and so they sell the good names. That's where the opportunity is.
Well, I'll leave you with this one. In the people that look at the stuff I look at,
yeah,
I'm probably the only one there that is still somewhat in your camp, and that if we do this right going forward, which it appears like we have no intention of doing, if we did, I think we could still grow our way out of this.
Yeah, well,
and the people on the other side, people in my group, think I'm an idiot for saying that. The thing that is weird, Kenny, is when I started, and then probably in your day too, we both started about the same time. If a company all of a sudden had, the market, you and I always thought the market was a god; it knew everything, right? And now, when you get something comes up, and pick even Nvidia. All of a sudden, people think they're doing better, and a stock runs up, 15, 20%. the earnings come out and they confirm that, yeah, they're doing better than everybody thought. And the market turns out to be correct. In our day, that once the market sentiment was somewhat confirmed, the stock kind of either held there or maybe come back a little bit. But now you get a chairman out there who, they look like two big carny huskers. They're more marketing people than they are chairman. They come out and they give you some other stuff, and it runs up even from there. So the market's wildest dreams of how good a company can do, and they double the price of the company between earnings. The guy comes out, and yeah, we've doubled. And all of a sudden, wow, now they're really going good. We got to double again. That's the part that's kind of weird to me. No matter how good they're doing, no matter how much the market anticipates they're doing better, it seems like it's not enough. It just seems odd to me.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you. But, you know, let's see. Let's just see. While I hate to say it, I think it is what it is. You know, the pullback that I was looking for all kind of in the fall, September, October, I don't think is going to happen, because I think there's a lot of money on the sidelines, guys at big portfolio managers that were waiting to, and now they're falling behind their benchmarks, and so they continue to put money to work. So I don't think we're going to get the pullback I wanted, but that doesn't mean that there aren't other opportunities. And listen, you don't have to necessarily, this is what I say to people, don't feel like you have to do something every day if you're a long-term investor. If you got the right portfolio, you're good. You know, let it run and let it work for you.
Kenny, you had your dip a week ago Friday. What are you talking about?
Yeah, my dip. What was it? 3%?
Yeah, you had your dip. You'd be quick like a bunny. Get in there, buddy.
Quick like a bunny. I want 8 or 9%. 3% to me is not enough of a dip.
Yeah, well, you're not getting the big carrot this week. No carrot for you.
Yeah, no. For sure I'm not. All right, anyway, listen, I'm going
to
jump.
Or take care of yourself. We have Professor Hal. SP Futures up 2. NASDAQ Futures up 4. Not much going on. That's what we have been spouting about it. We do have gold down a bunch, almost down as much as it was down up yesterday, which is not so great. Thank God we got some puts. Hal, how are you, buddy?
Doing well. I'm in my office at on campus today. I'm taking over a class for a colleague who's on family leave starting this week. So
you're taking over the university?
Taking over a class.
Oh, all right. I thought you were buying the university out or something.
No, just taking over a class for a colleague who's on family leave. They just had him and his wife just had a baby.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Everybody healthy? Everybody good?
I'm finished polishing up a paper that I'm going to present this week at the Missouri Valley Economic Association. It's pretty interesting paper. It started during the summer, but it's an extension of what I've been doing with the Startup New York Enterprise Zone research that my wife and I started back when she was an undergrad at Westminster College in Utah. Just kind of an extension of that. And
Boy, that's a name I haven't heard from the past. And once in a while, we get a client in here with who has bonds on one of these enterprise zones or something. Boy, try and sell one of those things. Good luck. There's like no. Well, it's not that they're horrible. There's just no market on them. I mean, you know, you keep them, you're going to get your pay, your money. But what is? Take us down this road. I mean, I haven't heard of the city having a new one of those in a while. Were they successes, not successes? You can't generalize. I mean, first of all, explain what enterprise zone is for everybody.
Yeah, it's just basically a way you can hide your gains from taxes if you put them in what are called, I think they're called QOFs. And a QOF is just a qualified opportunity fund. Those funds are used to. It's kind of like a bank almost, where people put capital gains in it, and then they use these funds to make investments in low-income neighborhoods. And most of the low-income neighborhoods are communities of color. And the governors are the ones that pick them, and then they're certified by the federal government to be an opportunity zone.
Well, in Chicago here, a lot of them weren't. A lot of them were even in downtown areas and stuff. It was...
Yeah.
It's
well, one of the criticisms of Startup New York was, you know, it was Governor Cuomo's program where he had a lot of criticism in the press, which, you know, in New York is pretty progressive. He got kind of torn up by the press in New York State that his Startup New York zones were really kind of creatures that were operated by like friends.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So he got a lot of he got a lot of heat for that. And the problem with opportunity zones and startup startup New York enterprise zones is that doesn't really increase. I mean, suppose they do work. Suppose we find evidence that they, you know, they're effective at increasing the number of firms within a zone. And so you find this evidence, but the real question is it actually increasing GDP? Is it increasing the GDP? Is Startup New York increasing the GDP of New York State? Maybe, but what's the cost? Maybe it just shifts where those firms are started up. Maybe they would have started up in Pennsylvania, Connecticut, or Vermont instead of New York. So you're just basically moving the sand from the north side of the beach to the south side of the beach. You don't increase the amount of sand on the beach, right? And so maybe that's what opportunity zones are doing. Well, business that would have just been opened near some guy's house is now opened in an opportunity zone to take advantage of the
theory was, I mean, I think, boy, I go back a long way on this, but the theory was as cities change, Al, and you might have an area in, say, in Chicago or in New York. I'm thinking of the spot on what's just north of the Trade Center. What's that? What's that area down there? It's it used to be all when I first went out there, and you took the bus in from Newark. You went through there. It was all almost like produce. It was almost like a market area. All kinds of trucks coming and going. Same thing with some areas here. It was an area that may have had three or four trucking companies, all those kinds of things, and maybe for whatever reason, they went out of business, and there's graying hulks of trucking business, and you might have a square mile or two in the city that is now pretty much whatever the economy there, even something like the stockyards. The stockyards, the cows are going, where you say, all right, no, wait a minute. No, it's too big of a project for one person to walk in and buy up the whole area. It's too big of a nut for anybody to crack, basically. So you'll say, why don't we get in here, have some kind of financing where somebody can get financing a little cheaper from us. We'll knock down some of the buildings, we being the city. By the way, we'll pop another subway stop in here because we're going to turn this around into some... It's not going to be truck docks anymore. It's going to be people. It's going to be a neighborhood. It's going to be apartment buildings. It's going to be houses, whatever it is. And the idea is... It was a way to get all that started, where you didn't have to take over the whole thing. I mean, how the hell does somebody, one company, grab a square mile in Chicago or New York? Yeah. It's even more bizarre. So there was some method to the madness when the area was going downhill anyway, and you looked at it and say the area is perfectly good, just not for what was there before. I think is what the theory was here. And then you could have these enterprise zones you went out with, they call them, they TIFs, bonds, where they would sell bonds on the area, and then people who wanted to go in there and get financing could now get the financing at the rate that the state could get because they're non-taxable. That was sort of the theory of it. That's what I'm asking you, did any of them ever work out that way? Or some maybe, some not, I don't know.
Well, it's kind of hard to, I mean, the data will tell you whether the number of firms, because we use county level census business pattern data to analyze this, and we have modest effects, like micro manufacturing firms with like 1 to 9 employees, it's up 2 to 3%. Small service related industries are up 3% over the period, which is pretty modest. And then we account for we include firm count lags in our modeling. And we see more smaller firms turn into larger firms than larger firms turn into smaller firms. So there's modest evidence of it. And I think that's really all you can do with the kind of data that's out there. But again, and the problem with these zones is that suppose this square mile in Chicago is successful. Is it really creating new businesses that wouldn't have existed otherwise? Or is it just shifting where they're located? Which would imply that it's, cannibalizing other neighborhoods, right? And that,
well, it depends if you're growing or not. If you're growing,
I mean, if the overall city's growing, that's great. But if it's merely shifting where those new businesses are sparked into existence, then it's really not having an effect on the GDP of Chicago.
Well, there's no doubt you're correct on that. I just the instinct is if you have say what's so damn obvious, the Stockyards. Stockyards is ringed by neighborhoods. Okay, and all of a sudden you got how many square miles that was, 3 or 4 square miles.
By the way, where'd all those Stockyards go? I mean, where did all that processing meat go? Is it still happening in a lot of it's in Omaha.
A lot of it's out west.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, they moved west, but that was we used to live 3 blocks from there when I grew up. We moved out.
I've heard some stories about the Stockyards in Chicago back in the 1800s.
Oh, it was the book The Jungle.
Yeah.
Who wrote that? God bless.
Well, the rivers, because people can't own the rivers were polluted. So
the at one time, how's this for a statistic? Chicago had like 300,000 people, and London had, I don't know, a million or two or something. Other cities had a million or two. Between the Stockyards and then, of course, the skins you use for tanning and stuff, they were all on the north side, all the tanning factories. The amount of I use the term waste in Chicago with 300,000 people was more than any other city in the world.
Oh, man.
And
well, you know, the movies of the 1800s do not do the time period justice. Like in New York, there were probably 40 horses dying per day in the streets and just left to rot.
Yeah.
And can you imagine all the poo and urine in New York City at that time?
It had to put disgusting to a new word.
Yeah, in the time of Jesus, people washing feet is really important to a person that grew up in Jesus' time, because the streets were literally covered in urine and feces from animals. So when you wash somebody's feet, that is a really powerful statement. Today, we're like, wash people's feet. What's the big deal about that? But no, back then, when you're walking around in sandals, it was a huge symbol.
Yeah, if you had your L.L. Bean duck boots on walking through, it wouldn't be that big of a deal, but nobody had those, right? But yeah, you look at those sorts of things. I mean, one of the most I don't want to go into it here, one of the most fascinating books you could ever read, and there's a couple of them there. It has to do with the history of Chicago really is the history of water management and waste management, because of the way the city grew, and because of the unusual nature of the topography and the streams and so forth. And
the geography of the Midwest is unbelievable, because that river system was a products distribution system. It was a highway system. And those kinds of river systems don't exist in Africa, but they exist in Europe and they exist in China, and it's just an incredible source of development.
Well, yeah, that's why these places, I mean, for a long time, the only city in the country...
They show up on rivers for a reason, right?
Yeah, well, the only city in the country for a long... Now, of course, everybody's got a million people, but the only city in the country that was over a million people that was not on a navigable waterway was Indianapolis. Mm. Every other city was on a navigable waterway of some kind.
Was Indianapolis a hub for railroads? Is that why it...
A little bit. Not really, because they kind of went this way. Some of them were...
That's why Atlanta's a big...
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. They're a railroad hub.
Railroad hubs, yeah.
But in the... That's one of the... When you look at some of the history... Well, you get me started on railroads. If you look at... If you bought a car at Oldsmobile, a big plant down in Kansas City, and you might say, how the hell did they get a plant down in Kansas City? One of the reasons is that it wasn't the Monon line, it was the, I'll think of it, the Wabash line, the Wabash Cannonball. There was a line that went from Detroit through Illinois, Indiana, to Kansas City that did not come through Chicago.
Mm.
And then there's a spur that comes into Chicago that's actually one of the commuter lines from the Southwest. I know the history of some of this, not all of it. And, the reason, so the you could get parts and finished cars back and forth from Detroit to Kansas City because of this rail line. If you would have had to go through Chicago and switch, why would you need Kansas City?
Yeah,
you could have been anywhere, but because they had a direct line, there was a big junction in somewhere down in Indiana. What the hell's the name of it? There's a town down there where your Pennsylvania Railroad and the Wabash and a bunch of others all came through. I'll think of the name of it. Richmond, Indiana was a big rail hub. But these are towns that were, you know, built for these reasons. I was at a... God, talking about weird. I was at this funeral maybe 2 months ago, out in Marengo, right? I don't know if you know where Marengo is, but it's just one of these, it's a city northwest of Chicago. And we go right next to the cemetery is this railroad line. And I go, boy, you know, I wonder. The first railroad line out of Chicago was Chicago to Galena, Illinois, because they had tin mines in Galena. Now, the thing was, you know, the charter was granted in like 1830-something. By the time they built it, it was 20 years later. But literally, it was like the first railroad line. It was not like to New York or any place. So that was the line. And so I'm in this cemetery. Across the street, yeah, on this little, it looked like two city house lots. It's another cemetery. And all the headstones are like half a foot off the ground. They're all crumbling. I'm sitting there going, those had to be the guys that worked on the railroad. They're all buried over there. And God knows what their families even know where great-grandpa is. But, you know, that's how the you know, all the way, all those towns, Marengo, there's probably eight of them, I'll think of here in a second. All along, you wonder, why are they all in kind of in this row? Well, that's where the railroad was. Is. Mm. Like Belvedere, all those places, and all the way through to Galena, Elizabeth, all those towns around the railroad. And that's the way, you know, a lot of this stuff. But, yeah, it's not unusual, though, when you have, get back to what we were talking about, parts of the city that all of a sudden just don't match anymore. You know, you don't have a stockyard. You don't need a big transportation hub. You don't need... If you look at the rail lines in Chicago, every single rail line had a way to get to the stockyards. Because that's where all the meat, the processed meat came out of, to feed the country, for God's sake. But if you
there's a lot of rail lines in Oregon and Idaho that you rarely ever see a train go on because the interstate system kind of took over. I mean, the competition from the truckers is, a lot more significant out west than I think it is in the Midwest.
Well, but you also, if you get on the Illinois Central, not Illinois Central, the Union Pacific main line, which is next to Route I-80 and right next to Route 30, they're all in the same area, right? They're the best ways to get out there. Yeah. I'll bet you see a train every 15, 20 minutes.
Wow.
It's matter of fact...
I grew up in Borden, Oregon, right there on the rail line, and I don't recall ever hearing a train coming through town. And it was right next to the Columbia River. The Columbia River was like, before they dammed it up, the Columbia River was very much like the major rivers of Africa, which were not navigable. You couldn't ship goods up and down them because of the waterfalls and the steep drop-offs. You could float down it, but you couldn't float up it. When you get to waterfall, you gotta pull all the goods out of the boat, walk it beyond the waterfall, and then jump back on the river. So, and the water used to run really fast through there. But when they put in those dams along the Columbia, they made it navigable, so you don't really need the rails anymore. Plus, then you have the 18-wheeler trucks on the highways.
So. Yeah, but nothing is more efficient in terms of fuel or anything else than a railroad. I mean, you're not even close.
Yeah. Well, the rails aren't really used in northern Oregon. The rail line that basically runs along the Columbia is, I don't recall ever hearing a train going through there when I was a kid.
Well, probably not. I mean, maybe
different now, but yeah, I just don't hear it.
Well, I have actually, when I was a little younger, what I loved to do in the Midwest.
The BART system on the Columbia is pretty impressive. Like, we have a port in Lewiston, Idaho. It's sold as Idaho's only seaport. And it's basically the Columbia River into the Snake. And it's, they have these huge barges that come right into Lewiston, Idaho. They got a port, looks like something you might see in a mouth of a river on the ocean. It's pretty incredible for a town of only 28,000 people.
You need to take a barge trip next time you come to Chicago, to Illinois or the Mississippi River. It's unbelievable.
Is Vince Vaughn the host of it, like in the movie?
No, we went on a...
If Vince Vaughn is the host, I'll definitely sign up for it.
We'll get a list. We had a group, the U.S. and China used to have, I don't know if they do anymore since we're fighting, all kinds of exchanges between agricultural people and stuff. And one, there was a person who was allied with the firm here, never really worked here, but he was allied with the firm. Well, I guess he did work here, but they were part of these groups, and they'd have people in here from China for like 2 weeks. There'd be like 15 people from China, and we would, they'd give them lectures at the CBOE, at the Board of Trade, teach people how to do crop insurance, which we have here, Took him to an ethanol plant, which I went. That was a riot. Of course, they were all upset when the guy says, there's no phones in here. You can't take any pictures. They were not happy. We also went on a barge tour. God, was that fascinating.
I can imagine. I love that kind of history.
Well, I mean, we were on one, you know.
I like history that punches you in the face.
We were on one barge, and, you know, the thing was sitting up there. You sit out and having a beer, the guy talking to you. It's not the same. Then you see 12 barges all hooked up with one towboat. I tell you what, Hal, I went in. You got a little tour of the towboat.
Uh-huh.
So in I go, and I felt like saying, why don't you get these people out of here? Let me drive this. give me a minute, buddy. I can handle this.
That Yellowstone prequel I was telling you about a couple weeks ago, 1923. Him and the heroine and the hero had this epic journey out of Africa. It's just incredible. And, you know, elements of Jaws, all these different movies are part of the story and the plot. It's really incredible. But they're trying to get out of Africa, and the only way they get out of Africa is by riding a tugboat through the Red Sea up to, like, northern Egypt. It's fascinating.
Wow.
You know, being on a tug in the Red Sea and this floating ghost ship knocks over the boat, the tugboat they were on, it's just incredible. I mean, it's a really good... It's one of the best TV series I've seen.
Well, the lock between the Chicago River, it's the only lock I've ever been through in Lake Michigan, is like 2 feet.
Hmm.
We go through this lock in the Illinois River, it's 200 feet. It's 200 feet.
Oh, 200 feet.
And
oh,
you're in the bottom of this thing, and you look at the top, and you go, if there was ever a leak in this thing, we're toast. All of a sudden, the water comes in, and up you go, and they're sitting there going, wow. This is...
That's impressive. That's Panama Canal type.
Yeah,
blocks.
Yeah. It's wild. Maybe it's 150.
Blocks along the Columbia are like that too, but I think they're probably smaller in scale, just enough for one barge to get through.
That's the whole thing here. They only allow the barges are three across.
They're basically water elevators.
Well, they want to go four across and three deep. So. Yeah. The locks in the Illinois River can only handle 6 barges at a time, and they want them to do 12. But it's like to put a new lock in is like, what the hell did I say? It's a million carpenter hours and something else. It's a massive undertaking.
Wow.
To double the size of a lock. Anyway, hey, we've got Money Supply coming out end of the month here.
Yeah, I can't wait to update.
Why don't we go to break? Let's see what this market running up like this. Leads me to believe that that's going to be a bulge number, but I don't know that for sure. SP Futures up 75 cents. NASDAQ Futures on 7. We'll go to break. We'll catch everybody up on all this stuff. We'll be right back with Professor Hill.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Ricky on the board. SP Futures unchanged. NASDAQ Futures down 11. We got some things getting clobbered here, like gold is down the same amount. It was up yesterday, $150. That's a lot. Over in Europe, we've got, what do we got in Europe? We've got something here in a second. The defense stocks have retreated, but the markets are still up. DAX up 21.1%. FTSE up 24.2%. CAC around up 30.3%. So moderately bullish over there. Over in Asia, we've got these guys are all up pretty heavy yesterday. Nikkei up 130.3%. Takachi is becoming prime minister today, so that's the news over there. Hang Seng up 168.6%. Shanghai up 52.4%. So that's a big move in the Shanghai bonds. 10-year down 1 base point 3.97, so under 4%. The Bund down 1 base point 2.57. Oil still cannot really get out of its own. Even though it's up 46 cents, still 57.98. Gold, ouch, down 123.42.35. So it was over 4,300 yesterday, not so today. Foreign exchange, dollar 116. Against the euro. Euro was 117. It was 115. Now it's in the middle, 116. But still fairly volatile. Pound 133.7. It was over 135. Then it was 133.5. Now it's back sort of in the middle. Crypto down 1,800 bucks, 108.959. So it's still down from that 126 print high. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Looks like Toronto World Series.
Good morning, Chief. It's currently 41 degrees right now with a high of 65. Sunny and breezy today. Tonight will be a touch of rain, probably, otherwise clearing and breezy with a low of 50 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 63 degrees right now with a high of 92. Sunny most of the time and very warm. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 68 degrees. Traffic in Chicago is not looking too bad today. Inbound Kennedy from Monroe's, 26 minutes. We're looking at about 40 minutes. Inns from Lane Cook. Eisenhower from Wolf, 43 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th, 21 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 35 minutes. MLB, Blue Jays beat Mariners 4-3, leaving the series 4-3. Blue Jays are winners. NFL, Lions beat Buccaneers 24-9 yesterday, as well as Seahawks beating Texans 27-19. This Thursday, October 23, we have Vikings at Chargers at 7:15 p.m. Back to you guys.
So, Hal, are you happy with the Toronto winning that series?
Oh, I'm sick. The Mariners had a lead.
Yeah.
They left the best pitcher that they had, the one that had that no-hitter into the eighth inning in New York that I saw, that I was in person
yep.
for back in July. They left him in one too many innings. He just wasn't ready. He's been injured, and they're trying to bring him back, and they should have went to their bullpen quicker. I was yelling at the screen because he kind of got hit up. He was out there for three innings, and he got kind of hit up in the second inning. And I'm like, man, he's got to go. You got to pull him.
Oh, you're one of these one hit, you pull the guy. You're one of those kind of people.
Well, no, I just in that seventh game with the incredible bullpen. The Mariners had a really awesome bullpen. Their bullpen was much better than Toronto's, and I think they should have brought everybody out. You know, just have a guy pitch a couple dudes. I mean, just use everybody. They had that lead.
You know, how come when a team scores three runs in like the second inning and whatever they did, then it's all the pitcher's fault. You can't score anymore the rest of the way. You need that extra run.
Oh, well, those Toronto Blue Jays pitchers, they had their starters out there in relief. They had one reliever out there, but he gave up a home run to Cal Raleigh. And then I think the other ones, all the other relief pitchers were starters. So they were throwing up because their bullpen was not doing very well. They were that's where the Mariners really hurt them, is the bullpen. So they brought out their starters.
Those
it was hard for the Mariners to manufacture some runs, and you know the Mariners are going to hit home runs, right?
Yeah, so. Well, but you can't have that the offense think that, well, okay, we scored three in the first, we're done. And
I know, yeah. Well, I think they're trying. I mean, they had a couple times where they had two men on base, left two men on base, a couple innings, and
yeah, they had them in at first and second. They bunted them over and didn't get them in.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, Toronto brings out those starters to pitch in relief because their bullpen isn't very good. And the Mariners, I think they left what's his name? He's their best pitcher. He was injured.
Yeah, he was the guy with the big righty.
Yeah, David Wong or something.
Yeah, something like that. It was my but.
He was the pitcher when I was at the Yankee game back in July. I mean, he was awesome that game. He had a no-hitter. I didn't know he had a no-hitter until about the fourth inning, because when you're at a game live, you don't really notice that stuff. When you're watching on TV, that's all I talk about. When I realized he had a no-hitter, I'm like, I'm staying until this thing's over, because I was going to jump.
Well, when you look up on the board, you see, like, runs, hits, and you see a zero in the hit spot.
I was like, but I wasn't really paying attention, dude. I was, you know, chatting up with my colleagues from A&T. We were there for a seminar, and they got us free tickets to the game. And I just told them I was going to leave probably about third or fourth inning, because I had an hour and a half ride on the subway to my in-law's house in Brooklyn. So, but when I realized he had a no-hitter, I was like, man, I got to hang around for this.
No, you can't just go to Brooklyn. You got to go all the way downtown and then back and then out to Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, I think the B. I was going to ride the B all the way. But at night, you have to get off at somewhere near Union Station or something to get on a different line, because at night, the B doesn't run all the way. So I was on the B, and then I got on the Q, and you have to go through Manhattan, so it's like an hour and a half ride.
I know we were one night, I was doing this for the CBOE. It was a hot night, right? So all the other the big shots all had cars. Every New York's got cars, right? Well, I know a car. So I
don't know why you'd want to have a car in New York. I mean, the taxes are.
No, I mean cars, meaning limos. Limos. We always had cars.
Yeah,
they're like cabs for the haves.
The rich, yeah.
Yeah, so
town cars.
I get on the subway, and of course we're on the only subway car that didn't have any air conditioning, and it's hot, and I'm sitting there, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm kind of sweating a little bit, and all of a sudden the thing stops right under the Bronx River for like 20 minutes, and there's this guy next to me. He must have been at the game. He's got the suit on. With the tie, with the top button still buttoned. And I'm thinking, this dude must have been one of those guys for the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or something. Not a bead of sweat on this guy.
Oh, yeah, he's probably just used to it.
Finally, you know, it only was like from, where was I? In like 58th Street or somewhere south of the park. It was only like five or six stops to Yankee Stadium on the Express.
Yeah.
I mean, you got there in a flash. I mean, it was pretty cool, actually. But anyway, all right. Back to the money. What do you think this money supply number is going to show on the? Why is it not coming up?
I think it's going to accelerate because you look at margin debt, three consecutive prints. FINRA margin debt, three consecutive prints over a trillion, and that seems to be accelerating.
It's right? it's like $50 billion a month.
Yeah, it's accelerating. So I think the M2 money supply is going to be. Right on our quadratic trend we've been tracking for about a year.
So, you know, what is that? Well, plus, you know, Trump's new guy in there already's looking for a half point. I mean, they want to pump it up. They want to pump it up. It's good for what they're in, their businesses, and, you know, that's what's being run in the place.
Well, Trump keeps talking about how if the Federal Reserve had interest rates lower, the interest payments would be lower, but the problem with that is you get more M2. You get more bank lending, you get more M2, and that right there is inflation, excessive growth in the money supply.
Well, yeah, they're at the point now where the inflation's the problem. There's too much sloshing around the system. You look at the stock prices.
Well, you look at Bitcoin. Bitcoin hit 110K.
No, it was 126. Now it's down to 108. It's actually.
Yeah, but I saw it hit it back up to 110 the other day.
Well, it's 109.284 right now. Yeah, but
it's coming back up, right? There is a correction. A bunch of people needed some money to pay off some debt or something, but back up.
The Wall Street Journal article, all it did was say the thing is a total scam. Remember they were talking about people shorting it and ahead of announcements and how it's being front-run and everything?
I always say that if it could be used to pay taxes, the volatility in it would probably go away because it would replace the dollar.
Okay,
if people could use it...
How can
it
replace the dollar? It's based on nothing.
Yeah, but if it could be used, it's not based on nothing because there's a scarcity in it. There's a built-in scarcity in it, unlike the dollar. So if it can be used to pay taxes and fines and fees and license fees and used for everyday transactions, I think the volatility would disappear.
Yeah, but hell, there's nothing behind it.
Well, there's nothing behind the dollar except the promise to raise taxes in the future.
There's not enough behind the dollar, but there's something behind the dollar.
There's not much behind the dollar when you got margin debt accelerating over $1 trillion. I don't see much behind the dollar.
We do have like a couple aircraft carriers.
Stability of the federal government to raise taxes.
We have a few aircraft carriers. We have a few bridges. We have a few. Yeah. Bitcoin has nothing.
Bitcoin has a built-in scarcity. That's the thing that makes it valuable to people who there are a couple of people that probably own it. It's a hedge against inflation. There's people who are buying it only for speculation purposes.
It's got
two components.
It's an artificial stock.
Yeah. I don't see it as an artificial stock. I see it as a wannabe. It's probably the preferred way to do money because people don't trust the dollar and the Federal Reserve printing money enabling the Congress and the President to run these huge budget deficits and grow the debt.
I have this discussion with people on Bitcoin all the time. All the foibles going on with the dollar.
I don't own Bitcoin, by the way.
I know what I'm saying. All the foibles with the dollar, and you and I will agree on those. Like, you know, it's the one thing. We agree on a lot of stuff. We'll agree on that.
The dollar is
turning to something that makes zero sense. I mean, Kenny was on one day talking about they're going to regulate it, and I go, okay, how are they going to do that? What do you mean they're going to regulate it? Who do you call? I mean, PTI Securities is regulated.
Honestly, I don't want the federal government to regulate it at all. I want
okay, so you
investors
don't,
and consumers and whatnot.
Okay, but you go off on this tangent. If you have a somebody who invests, if you open up an account at PTI and you buy 1,000 shares of IBM, where the hell are you going to buy? You can buy nothing if you don't just have an open account. If we send you your statements for 3 months and they come back to us, we have to find you, okay? We have to find you, and we have to, if we can't find you, we're going to kick your money to the state of wherever the hell you're in, New York or whatever your state. How is it that you can have something that's traded in this society where if you lose your password, you're bleep out of luck, allegedly? Because yeah, trust us, nobody can get in there. Nobody can figure out that 20 years from now this account's been dormant and nobody will ever take it. Yeah. Oh, no, that can't happen. Okay, show me the person who's watching that. Well, the rules for everything else we do are fairly strict. And now we have something that says we don't need any rules here? That somehow or other...
Tom, that's no different than somebody losing their passwords or their keywords. That's no different than somebody burying $100,000 in the backyard. Except the federal government will just print the $100,000 and replace it.
Everything that's wrong with the dollar, I agree with you. But to go,
if the Fed and the Congress weren't inflating the currency like they were, Coin would not be.
I'm 100% behind you. But it doesn't make the alternative sweet. The alternative is still pretty sour.
Bitcoin is 110K because you can't print it. And
how do you know
they are printing the dollar?
How do you
that's
know?
Why it's 110K.
How do you know?
That's why it is. I mean, it's
how do you know you can't print it? How do you know that somebody somewhere isn't printing it?
I think if they were printing it, it wouldn't be at 110K.
Well, but you don't it know. You look at a total.
Can print it, but they have to put so much money into cracking the algorithm.
That's what we've been told.
Yeah.
Well, whenever I'm just saying.
All I'm saying is if they were printing it, just printing it, it wouldn't be at 110K. You're
looking at a government that both of us agree is doing a crummy job managing their money.
I think
actually,
it's
you
very
know what?
Hard to
you know what though? Hell, put it this way:
yeah.
If you and I are Trump, or somebody like that, we're doing a spectacular job.
Spectacular job of inflating the currency.
Yeah, and it's going to benefit them.
Yeah.
I'm going to say if you go back to
central banks always benefit a very small group of the population.
If you go back to the Weimar Republic when they did their stuff. They did it to screw with the French and the British and the reparations payments, correct?
Yeah, because I think the reparation payments were denominated in nominal
currency. So, but now, if Trump's German ancestry, or you and I'm not German, but if I had a German ancestor, the biggest beneficiaries were the farmers and people who own property. So, of course, if the price of wheat went up four times in a week, guess what? The nominal currency on your mortgage, you walked in with a big barrel of Deutschmarks, wherever they were.
And he's paid off your principal.
Yeah, you hand it to a banker and you say, I'm done. I'm going to bet you that the same families...
No more mortgage payment.
Yeah, but everybody laughs about the Weimar Republic. I'm going to say the same families that were able to do that to the farms in 1930 still own them.
Tom, they coming for you?
I think they might. And I'm going to say that, I'm not...
Coming to get you.
Oh, yeah, I'm saying that when he pays off the Doral in inflated currency,
yeah,
50 years from now, his grandkids still get on the Doral.
Yeah.
So it's not like there's no harm and no benefit here. There is, and there is.
Yeah, people who own real estate benefit from it. That's why my wife and I want to buy real estate. That's why my in-laws in New York own real estate, so...
Well, the problem with that is...
I think that's the way you beat the system is you own the real estate.
I think...
And you weather it out until your rents turn into cash flows.
Well, I think there's no doubt that theory is correct, but you have to be somewhat careful. And at 2007, well, I remember, I can't find the article, guy went through and he looked at the price of a house, and it went through how much it cost to own the house and what percentage of the population could pay for that house. With the 20% down payment that somebody might have given you. And it was 85% of the population could not afford a house. And I'm going to say it's much worse now. Now, if you double up on income, husband and wife, now that means you got to pay for child care and all the rest of the stuff. So it's not an easy double. But if you do that, that's how people are scrimping to get in these houses. I mean, listen to the show, you listen to Nancy all the time, Audrey's saying, everybody wants a house, absolute move-in condition, inspected, everything checked out. And you might say, if you're grumpy dude, you might say, these young guys are all lazy, they don't want to do any work. That's not the reason. Every single dime is going for that mortgage and for the insurance and for the taxes. If all of a sudden that air conditioner pops, they got a problem. They can't afford it.
Yep.
And everybody's strained to the max, just like they were in 2007, only probably worse.
Yep. I agree 100%.
Because insurance is what?
It's because the Congress and the President and the Federal Reserve are all partners in a big scheme to inflate the currency.
We've been doing it since 1968, with a slight pause during the 80s because they let it get out of control once.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, right now, I think the Fed, this guy's totally capitulated to Trump. The other day, he said he's going to stop the runoff in the balance sheet. Well, the only thing, what you were talking about, the money supply growing because of margin interest growth, the Fed's job, if it's growing too fast, is to retard it, correct? And how do you retard it? You let your balance sheet run off. Now, if they're going to stop doing that, they're not going to retard it at all, are they? They're just going to let it go where it's going.
Well, I think with our new paradigm, which is not really a new one, it's been around since 2008, they have to raise the interest rate on reserves to keep those reserves in the banking system. That's how they do it. They have to raise the reserves.
Yeah, but they're lowering them. They're going to lower them.
I know, yeah, yeah.
And the new guy wants...
They're going to lower the dam, and all that water, all that melt-off, that snow melt-off is going to pour over the dam.
Do you think there's any chance that Powell screws him and doesn't resign?
I don't think he's going to resign. I think there's just going to be a new Fed chair next year.
But if he doesn't, for those who don't know what we're talking about, I think he has another year and a half to go on his term on the board.
Oh, I thought his term was up next year.
No, his term is the Fed chairman. He's also on the board.
Oh, Fed chairman.
All right, so... Typically, when those guys are out,
they resign
and they give Trump an appointment. He doesn't have to resign. He can say, I'm still going to stay on the board, which doesn't give Trump another appointment.
Yeah.
He has to name somebody internally then for the Fed chair.
Well, I think he wants to be gone because...
Oh, I look at him. He wants out. Yeah.
He's seeing the M2 growing like it is. I don't think he wants... And then he's getting pressured to...
He wants no part of this. Yeah, and I don't blame him.
I think he wants out, yeah. I think he's trying to find a way out.
And that should be a piece of education for every citizen.
Yeah.
Oh, man, who's going to be the new chairman? Trump's kid or something?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, they thought they were going to have...
Scott Bessent, I don't know.
Well, they said they might have the Secretary of the Treasury do both jobs.
Trump. After his first term, I think he trusts very few people, and he has like Rubio doing two jobs, and I think he wants to keep a circle small. But I could actually see him doing something.
You
like
seen the news yesterday? They're busting down part of the east portico.
I haven't seen that, huh?
Yeah, for the new ballroom or something, for the new.
The
guy said none of the White House is going to be disturbed, and sure enough, it's being disturbed. Is there anything you can believe?
Well, the ballroom apparently is going to be really fabulous.
Okay, so what? Why do we need a ballroom after all these years? You're telling me there's no place in there?
And then they're going to have that patio. They got that patio for next year's. It looks.
Did you see the Oval Office?
There's a lot of gold in the White House.
All the historical pictures are gone and everything.
I saw a bunch of paintings covering the walls. Like I saw
this is obscene. It's absolutely obscene. Anyway,
well, last time I saw the Oval Office walls, they were like paintings.
Yeah,
and like they looked like presidential paintings, like stacked on top of each other all over the place.
Yeah, I mean I've never been in there, but now it's totally different. It's all gold stuff. It looks like
Well, it looks like Trump International in Vegas with all the gold.
It looks just like gold
brass fittings and stuff. Yeah.
It's pretty scary. So what if we
well,
get
that's
a
his brand?
Well, you know, so that, that's well, brand. Yeah, but it's not his house.
I know. Yeah, but every president they go through and they remodel the thing.
Not to that extent. Yeah. Anyway, what if we get a big money supply number? Then what? Where are we going? Market's going to go even higher.
Better be in the stock. I mean, it might be too late to. I would probably be in it because I don't see the Federal Reserve raising the interest rate on reserves. I see M2 continue to scream upward, and I see margin debt continuing to grow.
Well, so, last week I was mentioning to
if you have real estate, it's a good time to hold real estate. Maybe in a couple of years you'll be able to pay off your principal with the.
The only wish with this stuff, if you want out, you can't. This whole idea of I'm going to get the top tick. You're not going to get the top tick. If you think that the it's going to go on for another couple years, which maybe I'm with you on that. In fact, I could be right with you on that. You got to plan. This is one man's opinion. If you think it's going to go for 24 months, get your ass out at 18 to 20 months. Leave a little something for the next guy. Yeah. Don't think that you're going to. If you think real estate prices are going to hang in there for another 2 years and go higher, plan on putting it on the market a year from now, if that's what you think. You know, but I'm not talking about your house, if you got a second house or whatever. You can't.
Well, I say don't sell the real estate.
Ever?
Try to, you know, like in New York City, you don't want to sell real estate. You don't, I don't think. Unless, you know, you're retired and you have no heirs and you want to move to Florida and buy a house, a couple houses with cash. My in-laws don't sell real estate. They don't.
Not selling real estate is a great idea if you got in at a good price.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you buy it at the...
Yeah, but if the Fed keeps creating this inflation, if the Congress and the President and the Fed all partner together to continue this inflation, real estate's a great place to be, I think.
Well, unless they start getting a...
Because, I mean, think about this. The rents eventually are going to be much higher than your mortgage payments. You're going to have some serious cash flow there.
I'm saying... If we trade the last decade, I'm all over this. I'm worried about trading the next decade as if it was the last decade.
Yeah. Well, all I remember is in the early 2000s, I used to think a mortgage payment over $800 was excessive. Now, I mean, it's really rare that you would see something like that. Or the rent, you know, renting a one-bedroom apartment was like, I remember it being like $400. Now you can't even rent an apartment for... under, not even close to $1,000. It's got to be $1,200. So, you know, young people, you know, they see rents today at $1,200. They just see that as normal. I see it as like odd because
you can't find any place here for $1,200.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like not like Chicago. I'm talking like in areas like Greensboro and Utah where the rents aren't, you know, out of control.
Well, I'm just saying you can't at some point.
But that's young people, young professionals. They see the rents today. And they look at the rents today as I looked at $300 rent back in the 90s, you know.
Well, Nancy's putting people in houses now. When I say putting people, she's getting mortgages for people that have bought a home. And the mortgage, I don't know if you add the taxes and all the other stuff on top of it, are cheaper many times for a much nicer place than where they were paying rent.
Yeah.
But now the question is, it's how far can the rents and the housing prices go further than people's ability to pay them?
Yeah, the problem is the apartment complex can be maintained by the owner, hopefully, whereas you have to maintain the house that you bought. So that's why they're going for those, hey, everything's got to be 100% right.
Yeah, you know?
The AC's got to be, it's got to last at least 10 years, and you got to inspect the whole thing. Because, like you said, people can't afford the mortgage payment. So if the AC goes out, they're not going to pay their mortgage payment. They're going to get their AC fixed.
Well, there's no doubt. I'm saying is it's at some point those lines cross.
Yeah.
In 2007, it got to the point where 85% of the people couldn't afford the housing price. Now, I think we're above that now. Now, my hope would be is that everything steadies for a few years, people get nice raises for a few years, and all of a sudden it all evens out that way. That's one way it evens out. The other way is not so much fun, is it?
Well, my hope is that we have... these investments that have been promised come to fruition.
What investments?
Well, I mean, the president keeps talking about how we have all these investments coming to the United States, and they're all promises. We don't know if these promises are going to pan out, but my hope is we get these promises and these facts. Like in Virginia, on the local news, they're building a Merck pharmaceutical factory in rural western Virginia, north of where we live in North Carolina. They're breaking ground. My hope is these investments come to fruition, and all these investments are demand-side stimulus until those factories open and the production lines are populated by workers. My hope is we get a bunch of new factories and we get.
Why do you believe any of this crap?
Well, I'm just hoping.
I am too, but if you're going to have a situation where you're going to change the dynamic, okay? I'm not a fan of tariffs, but say you use something like tariffs to equalize the, you know, slave, well, say different kinds of labor, ability to pollute in other places. If you're going to use tariffs to even that out, I could pretty much roll with you on that, okay, if somebody were to do that. Now, the idea is to even the stuff up. But if you're gonna do that, you have to make, I think in America, what makes us different is for guys like you and us to say, wait a minute, it looks to me like I can be in the nail business here now. We don't have to get them all from China. I don't know where we get them, but I can go to the bank, and because now we're not going to let guys just dump nails on us, I'm going to get in the nail business, and I'm going to take Hal with me. And we'll take Ricky with us, too. He's a good worker. And we're going to get in the business. And by the way, we're going to be able to go out and get a loan, and we're going to... That has to come from the regular way, in my opinion. We can go out and get stock. We can go to the stock exchange. We can go to the bond market. That's our way. Nothing that this dude has done with this on-again, off-again, on-again, off-again is going to make you and I go buy a factory. Because the day after we buy it, the tariff will be gone because he made a deal with the guy. I mean, it's so inconsistent in that regard. So the other flip side of it is we're going to have these big news items where Saudi Arabia, who we don't even like, the guy's a friggin' murderer, runs the place. He's gonna bring $10 billion here. That's gonna save us. I don't buy that at all. I don't buy that at all. That's not our way.
The CCP disappears people too. So you know, dealing with the CCP or the Saudi prince, I mean, to me, it's there's no difference in the two, right? A billionaire that criticized President Xi Jinping during the COVID pandemic just disappeared. He just disappeared.
I'm just. Right? What I'm saying is these. I want an atmosphere. Where
these foreign leaders are bad people.
Okay,
disappear people,
what I'm saying is the American
economically or through you know murder.
If you don't believe, I mean, it should be done in a manner, and I don't disagree with everything he's doing. By the way, I do think some of his stuff has to be added. But the idea that everything I've seen in the Midwest, every single one of these deals has been a fiasco.
Yeah.
The Foxconn thing in Wisconsin never got built.
Yeah.
And how much money did they give those guys?
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
well, that's what I'm saying is until the factory opens and the workers populate the production line, it's all demand side stimulus, which is inflationary.
So. But this, how many times have this tariffs been off and on again with China in the last since he's been around the last 10 years?
Yeah,
I mean, how many times? 8 years. How many times would we ever have said, okay, we know exactly what this guy's doing. This is the future. We're going to go do it. Could we ever possibly have done that and got the financing to do it?
Well, I think what he's trying to do is he's trying to bring all these factories that have been offshore. I think he's trying to bring it back because the middle class.
That's what he's saying, but it isn't happening.
And I'm a hopeful. I'm not saying I'm certain. I'm just hopeful that it comes to fruition because, you know, the middle class has been hollowed out, especially in the areas that I live in.
You are getting no argument out of me on that. I'm saying the process, the on again, off again, it's not conducive to somebody actually doing something.
What Trump does is he leverages crazy to move the.
Okay, but that's I don't want that. If you and I are putting a factory up,
that's a style. That's a style.
Okay,
that
but
ruffles a lot of
the style sucks because it ain't helping anybody.
Well, you know, let's pray that it works.
Okay, let's give another whatever.
Because what we've been doing, Tom, hasn't worked at all. It just made people on Wall Street very wealthy. Monetary policy and the fiscal policy that creates these huge deficits and debt make a very few people very wealthy.
I want what you want. What I'm seeing isn't getting
us here. All I'm saying is what we've been doing for the last 20, 30 years hasn't
okay,
worked.
Okay, so whatever else he wants to do is going to be okay.
No, I'm just saying I'm hoping that this effort results in a lot of reshoring.
I'm hoping for a lot of stuff. I hope when I buy a lottery ticket, the numbers are on there. They're not there.
Yeah.
Guess what?
All I got to say, Tom, is the way Republicans and Democrats did it in the past, and I'm not a fan of it. I'm just saying what we did was much worse. Hopefully this turns out to be something. Maybe there's some supply.
All right, whatever. I hope you're right, too.
I'm just hoping that all these investments that were promised to us when he went through the Middle East and and said he got this billion from this guy and this billion from that guy. I'm just hoping that those investments, they're actually made in electricity production.
Is it okay with you if I keep my eye on the ball and see what's actually happening instead
of... That's fine. But all I'm saying is we can do it this way, which is not the best, or we can do it the way we've been doing it, which resulted in the getting to the middle class.
We let people do a lot of stuff, go overseas and do a lot of things and not pay people enough.
Sometimes the only choices, Tom, are what is least bad. And what we've been doing for 20, 30 years is bad. So let's try something that's maybe less bad pray for the best.
I think whatever you're going to do, you have to be consistent on it. You got to be able to put a plan together because you're asking people.
But I think the only way to get things done in D.C. is to move the Overton window, and he leverages crazy to do that.
I'm not going to bet your kid's future on crazy.
That's why I'm trying to get real estate properties. I want to leave my kids with real estate so they have wealth. That's what I'm trying to do.
Well, that's good.
Because I don't think any of this is going to happen. I think what we're going to have is an inflation.
Well, we'll be talking about it. But the S&P futures up 75 cents, Nasdaq futures down 4. So the rally yesterday is holding. Stocks are holding. Everything looks good today.
Plan for the best or plan for the worst. Hope for the best. That's all I'm saying.
What are you making this big gold sell-off?
Yeah, well, you know, I think people might have some positions to cover, and they got that. You know, they see it at 4,000. It's just like the pullback in Bitcoin. It's gonna reaccelerate.
All right. Well, there you go. We'll be back tomorrow. Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.